Welcome and thanks for listening to Relational Practice, a social work podcast. I'm Dr. Jodie Parks.
And I'm Rose Mackey, and we're both private practice social workers who work in child protection and trauma. Today we are recording on Darral Land, New South Wales, Australia.
Please follow our podcast, like us on Facebook and, I don't know, Instagram. What do you do on Instagram? Do you like?
Yeah, you can like.
Okay. Whatever you do on Instagram, I'm not an Instagram person. And please remember to send us any questions or comments you have on our email. Our email will be in the notes, but just in case, it is relationalpractice01@gmail.com. We are after any stories from you about your practice that we can read out on our podcast, but also just if you want to send us comments, if you want to send us feedback, if you want to send us ideas for topics, feel free.
And thank you to those listeners that have given us feedback that's come through email, social media and direct messages. We really appreciate you all listening to our episodes so far and taking the time to give us some feedback.
We've had some great feedback, haven't we?
We have. It's been surprising.
It's been very surprising. We've had more than two people listen.
Yeah, which my son said, there's no way any more than four people will listen to in the first month.
I know. It's been very surprising. So thank you. I appreciate it greatly. We both appreciate it greatly. Thank you so much. I just wanted to talk about the email we got. We got a practice email, which I think is pretty cool. So I'm going to read that out. So then you'll all know, you know, if you do send an email in, it's not going to be scary. It's just, you know, you'll know what we want to do with it, basically. And basically what we want to do with it is just build this kind of community, build this kind of understanding about each other's practice.
Glaring at you, going, do not say that.
I'm not saying it. All right. So it says, hi, ladies. I love your podcast. It is so different to some of the other social work or practice ones I've listened to. I love that you are both so genuine in how you share your practice. I work as a caseworker in the foster care system. I've worked in foster care for about 5 years, so I feel like one of the old ones in the office. Honestly, the turnover of staff in the field is something that should be looked at. I agree. In my 5 years, I have seen so many things change in how I do my job. The changes have included what we call things, like birth family contact or looking for family, to how we do things. It seems like there are changes all the time, which really just increases the expectations on us. I'm not talking about accreditation expectations. It is important that we are meeting the needs of the children, families and carers we work with, but more about how we approach the work. For example, pushing restoration for children as their preferred permanency option when it was only last week that Mum couldn't attend a family visit because she was in hospital after being assaulted. How can restoration be an option right now when Mum is trying to manage her day-to-day life in the best way she can? Good question. How do I then have to put more pressure on her to talk about restoration when I know this cannot happen right now? I thank you for talking about the sometimes confusing and contradictory child protection and foster care system. It makes me feel connected and understood.
Nice.
That's a cool email with lots of big questions in there. I really love questions.
I do too. Lots of different topics we could talk about from that email. And hopefully to that listener, throughout our podcast series, we'll touch upon some of those big questions you've asked.
Definitely think we will. I think we should definitely talk about stuff turnover. From our opinion, it's only our opinion. I mean, yeah. And I guess, you know, you can choose to not listen to our opinion, or you can choose to take it or leave it, I guess, is what I'm trying to say.
True that.
And I really liked the, for me, it kind of says just the impact of that one size fits all
approach that we've been talking about.
Yeah, the impact of that on this person, this practitioner who was anonymous, who wanted to remain anonymous. Thank you so much for your email, and please send them in to us.
All right, today we're talking about attachment.
This is a huge topic,
but it's a very big topic, and as always, this is our perspective.
Yeah, our perspective only, and I guess yeah, we can only ever talk about our perspective, and it's about how we have interpreted and then applied the theory that we're talking about at any given time.
And I think one of the beautiful things about the practice world that we live in is that multiple perspectives make us richer.
Yeah.
They force us to think a bit differently, and they help us consider I guess, where we are along any continuum at any point in time. So it's just that another perspective. So attachment theory, kind of controversial, but we wanted to talk about it because we think it's important.
Yeah, absolutely.
And we have had this discussion in our planning for this episode, and we think it's important because when we first started as very young practitioners many moons ago, attachment theory was often talked about in the office, in our pods at work, with our supervisors, with our colleagues. And I distinctly remember most of the tools that I used early on in my day being steeped in attachment theory.
Yeah.
And what I've noticed over time is that that has dwindled. And there's been this different perspective that attachment theory is maybe not as relevant now as what it was, as what it once was.
Yes. Which is so weird, isn't it? Because why is it not relevant now when it was so relevant before?
Yeah. And it wasn't a new theory back in the early 2000s.
No, because attachment theory has really been around since the 60s. John Bowlby, who was the original theorist who came up with attachment theory, is a psychiatrist, an American psychiatrist. I mean, he's been talking about this theory since, I think, late 50s, and then really, really wrote about it in, I think, about 69.
69, I think he first published his first attachment work.
Yeah, and then in the 70s. So it's not old.
In the 80s.
Yeah, and then in the 80s, that's true. That's true.
So, yeah, it's just, there's been a shift, I believe, and within the last 5 years have finished a master's, and I did lots of theory work in my master's, but do you know, I did not once in any subject have attachment theory as a theory presented by the university I was with.
Wow.
And it was not a theory that we discussed in our master's in that whole entire time.
I mean, I want to say, is that true? Of course it's true. You're not going to say something that's not true. It's crazy, isn't it?
I mean, I used it in some of my assessments, but yeah. It was not when I can see the textbook and the main textbooks we use for theories, and it's not even in that textbook. I double checked the other night.
What do you mean? That just seems insane because you're working with people.
I know.
Like, we work with people who have relationships with other people.
And emotions.
And emotions. That's right. Like, how can attachment theory not form like an integral part of how you understand what it is that you're seeing when you work with people? And I guess let's just quickly say that about theory. I guess theory is supposed to be something that helps you to understand what it is that you're seeing.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the whole purpose of theory. So for attachment theory, it is about, okay, well, how are these relationships impacting on the person's emotional well-being and their, I guess, regulation, their relationship history, their everything, basically everything. I think it underpins everything when you think about people as people and humans as humans.
Mm. So thinking about a master's in social work.
Yeah.
Consciously or unconsciously, removing attachment theory from its teachings is quite insane.
It's really, really strange.
And one of the reasons why we wanted to talk about attachment so early on in our podcast series.
Yeah. Because I think one of the things that I kind of have always thought about attachment theory is that I think it's very often misunderstood. I think it's often mislabeled, and I think attachment and using the language attachment is very emotive, but it means different things to different people.
Yeah.
And I think if you are not someone who understands attachment theory, and you don't have to know the ins and the outs, you just have to, as we have developed, your own understanding, but also your own ability to verbalize what theory means for you and how you have interpreted the theory and use it as a sense-making mechanism.
And it's okay to go back and reread and refresh yourself on this theory or any other theory.
Yeah.
So what is attachment theory? So as we understand it, it's an emotional and psychological connection that occurs almost as a consequence of the relationship that exists. Yeah, it's a behavioral system, which I think is really important because you don't often hear when you think about attachment, and the words that often come to mind are serve and return, secure base, close proximity. But this other part of attachment theory is that it's a behavioral system through which we regulate our emotions, especially when we're under distress.
Yeah.
It is how we achieve security by seeking proximity from another person or not.
Yeah, very true.
And I guess one other important aspect of attachment theory that you probably all know is that it's biologically based.
Yeah.
And it contributes to our survival.
So what that means is that it's not, babies are born with the ability to seek caregiver attention to have their needs met. And those basic interactions begin the process of serve and return exchanges, which therefore builds the bond and then the attachment between a baby and a caregiver, or more than one caregiver. So you can have more than one caregiver.
Yeah, there's nowhere in the literature that we have read that or understand it to only be one. There are absolutely ages and stages in early attachment. And if we think about infants and their process, I guess the process in which they go through to attach, as we understand it, between, is it 0 to 4 months?
Yeah, 0 to 4 months. That's when the bond is occurring. So that's the bonding stage. And so that's where those, very much biologically based. It's very much this baby, does something to signal to a caregiver that they need feeding, changing, something.
So we're talking about their crying,
yeah,
their making faces, the suckling noises that babies make, yeah, signaling, I have a need.
And this is something that research has shown happens across cultures, across social contexts, across
other animal species.
Other animal species. That's why it's biologically based. And because it means it's about survival. It's about survival. It's about getting the attention of this, of a caregiver, to be able to actually survive through infancy.
Yeah.
So 0 to 4 months, we've got the process of bonding. 4 to 6 to 8 months, we've got the process of attachment and the making. So that is where the relationship between the baby at this, because 4 to 6 months, the baby and the caregiver is being tested. So the baby is trying to work out, and again, this is not conscious. It's not like the baby can sit there and work this out cognitively because they don't have the capacity. It's where you have those ongoing interactions that test whether the caregiving is going to be consistent, reliable, and predictable. Because that's the baby's experience of reliability, consistency, and predictability will therefore influence the attachment style that is developed.
Yep.
So then 6 to 8 months to 12 months, that's where you have the process of clear-cut attachment. The other thing that happens, though, between that attachment and the making stage is that the baby will develop a preference, an attachment preference. So that's kind of where, just say there are two caregivers. If the baby's crying, they'll probably want this one caregiver to soothe them, but it doesn't mean the other caregiver can't. It's just that child's preference at that time is for one caregiver over the other. And I guess if you've had, if you are someone who has children or you've been around children where there's been more than one caregiver who has met their needs, you'll see that. You know what I'm talking about because you would have seen it. You definitely would have seen it.
Saw it yesterday.
Did you see it?
I did see it yesterday. A little baby boy, he's almost 8 months old and has two stay-at-home caregivers. He's very lucky. And he was hungry and one caregiver was in it, explaining something to me throughout the assessment process. So the other caregiver tried to soothe him and prepare his bottle to give to him, and he was not having a bar of it. He wanted the other caregiver, but she was retelling something quite emotional. He eventually calmed down and the other caregiver was able to to give this baby his bottle, but he fussed for, you know, a period of time, making it very clear by holding his hands out, craning his neck and like crying, looking at her that he wanted her.
Yeah. And that's actually perfectly normal.
Yeah.
For that age, it's perfectly normal and it's what you would expect.
Yeah.
Definitely what you would expect.
But the other caregiver, she was able to feed him.
Yeah.
And he, you know, settled into that feed.
Yeah.
Was just not his initial preference at all.
No, that's right. That's right. And I guess there's some misunderstanding. I think initially there's some misunderstanding about the stages of attachment. I think most people seem to have this understanding that it takes some time. It's not like, you know, automatic, that it actually takes some time. But I don't know whether it is something that is understood that it takes 12 months for there to be clear-cut attachment. And I also think there's some misunderstanding about this process just when you're talking about older children or you're talking about children who are placed in different care environments with people that they don't know. This process still has to happen.
Mm-hmm. So can it happen more than once?
Of course. I think so. I mean, look, I'm not like the attachment expert, but I kind of know what I know about it. And then my understanding is, of course, it can occur more than once.
Yeah. And I've very often heard that attachment can be transferred, especially if it's, there's a secure attachment that can be transferred. But that's what I heard early on in my career. What I believe now is that we know that humans have the ability to repair and recover from trauma, and humans have the ability to change their attachment styles. And that's why I think when children are placed, if you think about children in the foster care system, in different placements, that there is that ability for them to attach to another caregiver. And if it's a reparative care environment, there to be healing and a change in their attachment style.
Yeah. But that transference stuff, I think, is actually about the internal working model.
Okay.
So the internal working model is part of attachment theory. And basically what that says is that I actually think we're jumping ahead. So let's talk about styles of attachment and then look
and then about the internal working model.
Yeah, because okay. I think it will make more sense.
Right.
So we said initial attachment theory was developed by John Bowlby in conjunction in the 70s and 80s with someone called Mary Ainsworth. And I feel like I'm telling some of you stuff you definitely already know. But anyway, just bear with us. Bear with us. And who did her own research, kind of extended the research of John Bowlby. And she was the theorist that came up with different attachment styles. And she did that by an experiment called the strange situation. And what that was a whole heap of mothers and babies. Well, the experiment was done with a whole heap of mothers and babies. And so she would ask the mothers to come into a clinical room and there would be someone recording the interaction between the mother and the baby at all times. But it would just be the mother and the baby in the room. And so she would initially ask the mums just to settle the baby down, just to kind of stay in there for a few minutes so that everyone feels like, okay, this room is okay. To get the baby in, you know, interacting with something like a toy or something, and then to leave. The mother would leave the room and leave the baby in the room. And then the researcher would see how the baby responded to that. How did the baby respond to the separation from mum at that time? Then mother would re-enter the room and then the researcher would look at how did the baby respond to mum coming back.
Mm. I think it's important to say if it's mums because we're talking about in the 70s.
Yeah, that's true.
And the context of that time.
Yeah.
Is very different to the context of today.
Yeah, very good point, Rose. That's why it's mums. I was using very gender language because let's face it, most caregivers in the 70s and the 80s were mums.
Yes.
Yeah, definitely.
But Mary Ainsworth's work was across cultures.
It was across cultures.
And across social contexts.
Absolutely. And she had replicated results in those different contexts. Mm. Which is why it can be something that we can have faith in and we can have some belief about. It's not like she just picked 50 middle-class white women from a middle-class suburb over in America and did the research with that and then generalised the findings for the whole
rest of the world, yeah. I actually think she was English. John Bowlby was American. I think she was English and her work was across cultures.
Yeah, right. Okay. Yeah.
So the attachment styles Ainsworth, I guess, derived from this strange experiment was secure attachment, avoidant or ambivalent resistant attachment types.
Yep.
And then later on in the 1990s, we had two other theorists, Main and Solomon, who added disorganized or disoriented attachment style.
Yeah. So just to quickly explain what they all look like. So a secure attachment is, I mean, I feel like that's the one that everyone thinks they know what it is. It's where the child has experienced consistent, predictable caregiving. There's evidence of really lovely parental attunement between the child. Not really lovely. God, I shouldn't have said that.
Just attunement.
There's evidence of attunement between the child and the caregiver or caregivers. And parental attunement is the ability for the caregiver to preempt the needs of the child at any given time. And the also includes the element of adaptability. So the caregiver can adapt to the child's ever-changing needs. So generally in a secure attachment, you'd expect relationships to be, you know, mostly settled, you know, everything's pretty much consistent, predictable. And everyone kind of knows what's going on all the time.
Yeah.
The kid knows, you know, if I do this, this is the response I'm going to get because that has been the experience of predictable, consistent caregiving.
Yes.
Yeah. Then if we talk about avoidant attachment style. So avoidant attachment style is where I kind of think of it as those kids on the little islands all by themselves, those children who do not rely on adults in any way, or will rely on an adult because they know they have to, but will rely on them to have their need met, and then that's it, that adult's dead to them.
Yeah, they're both sitting to the left.
That's right.
Got what I want and I'm on my way.
Yeah, that's right, because that child has learnt that that adults are not safe for them, that they cannot count on an adult to meet their needs consistently or at all, and that it's far better for them to become self-reliant because that way they can maintain their own safety.
And if you think about the emotional the emotional and behavioral system that is the other part of attachment theory, these children demonstrating their behaviours that they're going to avoid having any emotional connection with any adults at all costs.
Yeah.
They don't seek it out, and there's a big avoidance towards an emotional connection with the caregivers in their lives or adults.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. And if you are somebody that works in the child protection system or the at-home care foster care system, you know, these will be those children who, when a placement ends, they'll pack their belongings, they'll get in the car, they'll say, see ya, they won't look black, they'll be fine. They might have a few tears because maybe that's what they think people expect them to do. And then they'll get to the new home and within, you know, an hour, they're calling the new carers mum and dad.
Because again, they think that's what's expected, right?
Yeah, but also it's about getting the adults on side so that their needs can be met. Children on their own little island.
Yeah.
Okay, the next type, insecure type, is that we will talk about is, I'm just trying to see the language I've used because it's kind of called different things in different places. So it is ambivalent resistant attachment style, and really that's characterized by the child being anxious. I guess anxious in relationships with a caregiver. So it's a push-pull thing. So the child really wants there to be this relationship with a caregiver, but when they get the relationship, they then don't know what to do with it and they don't want it. So it's very much this kind of, I need you close, but I also want you away. I want you close, I want you away. And anxiety is a feature of this attachment style. It's a huge, it is sometimes called insecure anxious attachment style. So it just kind of depends on the literature reading. It's got different terminology, but I kind of know it as resistant ambivalent attachment.
It's very confusing, all the different languages that go with the different styles.
So then that's practice, isn't it?
It is.
We just make up our own words when we want to. All right, and then we've got disorganized attachment, as Rose said, was added later in the 1990s. And disorganized attachment is when a child's needs have been consistently not met and disorganized attachment is
where they need a relationship, but they doubt their own self-worth, and there's a fear of that intimacy. There's a real lack of coherent strategy for meeting their attachment needs, and their experience of relationships has been fear-based. So disorganized attachment is where the person will need relationships, but they doubt their own self-worth and they fear intimacy. So they have a real lack of a coherent strategy for meeting their attachment needs. They're fearful. Their experience in relationships is that relationships are scary.
Mm-hmm.
And they fear relationships. That's a disorganized, disoriented attachment.
Yeah. So their interactions have been consistently unpredictable.
Yes.
Consistently unpredictable and...
Fear-based.
Fear-based, yes.
You know, the abusive parents, the parents who the substance use is chronic, serious and persistent, and the elements that come with substance abuse parents is, you know, that criminal activity, the people they associate with, the fact that they're not going to have their needs met, they're not going to be fed.
Yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah, yeah. I agree completely. It's real. It's like every time I think about disorganized attachment, in my mind, I just think of chaos.
Yes.
It's chaotic and it's confusing.
Yeah. And scary.
And scary. Chaotic, confusing, and scary.
Yeah.
And it's always like that.
Whereas an avoidant attachment history is when you see someone that's shut out emotions.
Yeah.
And they're defending against hurt by avoiding. They're avoiding intimacy. And they're really dismissive of why relationships are important. And they're compulsively self-reliant. These are the island kids, yeah?
Yeah, avoidant. Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah.
And then the resistant attachment types.
Yeah.
These are the kids that are desperate for love. They really want to feel worthy. And they're constantly worried about abandonment. And they're expressing their anxiety openly.
Mm-hmm.
This is the push-pull, yeah?
Yeah, it's push-pull. Definitely push-pull. Definitely.
And then I think we've talked about secure. This is a healthy balance of attachment. There's autonomy. There's freedom to explore.
Yeah.
There's a secure base. They have a pretty healthy internal working model.
Yeah.
All right. So the internal working model, which is probably, again, not new for most of you. This is how we view relationships and our model of ourself. And others as negative or positive. We all have one.
Yep. According to attachment theory, we all have one.
Yes, that's what we're talking about.
I know. But if you don't believe in attachment theory, then you might not believe we have one.
Well, that's true. But I think it's not by now if you don't believe in attachment theory.
Well, maybe you just want to prove us wrong.
Well, that'd be kind of cool. So the internal working model is... Think of a big pie and there's three pieces of this pie.
Yes.
How do I view myself? How do I view others?
Yep.
And how do I view the world around me?
Yep. Those three parts of that pie make up your internal working model.
Yes. What else do you want to say about the internal one?
So it is something that is developed in response to your relational history. And so it is a representation of what your relationships have been like. And what it does is it actually then gives you that frame of reference for future relationships.
Yes.
That's the important part of the internal working model. Is it's like it's kind of like, I guess it's like a mirror. Like, it's like, this is what my relationships have been like.
Like.
Yeah.
And this is what I've learned to expect.
And this is what I've learned to expect. And moving forward, this is what they'll always be like.
Yeah.
So if you are, say, a kid and you've had you have an avoidant attachment style because you have had experiences where you haven't been able to rely on the caregiver, then you're going to view yourself as someone who has to meet your own needs.
Yeah.
I'm the most important person in my world because I am the only person I can rely upon, and everybody else is just someone that I have to take stuff from. Basically, I can't trust them.
Yep.
I can't trust them. See, that's how you view others, as untrustworthy, as people who are, you know, really out to hurt you. And then in terms of how you view your environment, you would probably, well, it's interesting because you'd either view it as a very scary place or you would view it as an area to be conquered.
Yeah.
To get your needs met.
Because you're self-reliant. So it doesn't really matter about the world around you because you're going to get there.
That's right. Yeah. The world is for you to kind of take what you want. So it's different. That's a really interesting one because it just depends more on, it depends so much on your temperament, and it depends so much on how you have organized those behavioral regulation, that whole process, how that has been organized in terms of how that will impact on you in terms of your model.
But generally, it's a pretty negative internal working.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Versus if I've had a secure experience, like I have, you know, really nice relationships with people, I feel safe, I feel like, you know, that I can go to people if I need help and they're always going to help me because they always have, then I'm probably going to feel pretty good about myself. Not all the time because, you know, there's highs and there's lows, but generally speaking, I think that I'm okay and I think that my world is all right, and I'm pretty curious about the others that I, other people that I meet.
Mm-hmm.
I just know that I'm going to, you know, even though I'm going to have highs and lows, the world's pretty safe for me.
Yeah. It's pretty positive internal working model.
Yeah, I'd say so.
Yeah. So if you had a resistant attachment kind of style, your internal working model would be, so you're desperate for love.
Yeah.
And you're desperate to feel worthy, but you actually don't. So you're, the way you view yourself, I would suggest, is pretty unlovable.
Yeah.
Desperate to be loved. So you're going to try to do things to get a response from others that will make them want to love.
Well, yeah, absolutely.
And you're really worried about abandonment. So you're going to hold on to others pretty tightly.
You're going to hold on for dear life.
Yes, and you're going to sometimes stay in relationships that aren't healthy or good for you because above all else, you don't want to be abandoned.
Yeah. It's really like just kind of think about the biggest features of resistant ambivalent attachment is that anxiety.
Yeah. So if you have a disorganized...
My God, chaos.
That's how much. The world is chaos. Your relationships are chaos.
Everything is chaotic. In my experience, it's so much that's the kind of group that's hardest to work with, whether it be children or adults.
And I think one of the reasons for that is that this is where you have a real, like, unorganized strategy for how you're going to meet your needs.
Yeah.
So you're going to be chaotic, eclectic, and the way in which you get your needs met by others is going to be ever-changing.
Yeah.
You're just going with what's presenting and adapting and trying anything to have your needs met.
Yeah. It's really hard to have a consistent, reliable relationship with somebody who is disorganized in the way that they approach relationships in response.
Awesome.
Because the thing about attachment is that it is not just about you, it's about the relational experience that you've had.
Yes.
And that you're going to have.
And it's also about the way in which you regulate your emotions.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, because it's all so intertwined, isn't it?
Yes.
Which is why you need to know about it, because it's all so connected.
And I think the attachment attachment styles, we have them as adults.
Yeah.
And they can change.
Absolutely. Absolutely, they can change. Nothing is ever static. Like, I think the thinking like years ago was that, you know, brain development was once your brain was wired in a certain way, you couldn't undo that wiring. Do you remember that?
Yeah.
Yeah. But then, you know, research has found that our brains are actually more plastic, as repeated experiences can actually start to form new
neural pathways.
Yeah, that's right. So, things can always change. And attachment, I think, is the same thing. Repeated, consistent, reliable experiences with another person or other people can always change the way that you view relationships.
And how you are in relationships.
Yes.
And impact, clearly, your internal working world.
Yeah.
I think you have a good practice example of that journey.
I think, yeah. Oh, I think we both do, don't we? Like the care assessment one?
Yeah.
Yeah. You do yours first. Yours is really good.
So I was doing an assessment within the last couple of years of a couple in their late 30s, and they were seeking to become kinship carers of a niece. And the agency who had requested the assessment were concerned about the potential male's criminal history, the potential kinship carer, his criminal history, and concerned about their drug use when they were, you know, in adolescence. So this couple had actually both had very traumatic childhoods, and I'm talking from very early childhood right through until they were adolescents.
Mm-hmm.
They actually lived in the same suburb and hadn't crossed paths, but the potential kinship carer, the lady, she had lost her mother at a young age and had been then physically and sexually abused by her father, and then removed and then placed with family, and then two family placements broke down, and she was quite a chaotic adolescent. She was homeless. She was experimenting with drug use and had a really rough time in her adolescence. The uncle, he had a very, very abusive childhood. He was physically abused, emotionally abused, and neglected his entire childhood. He was the subject of numerous reports to the Child Protection Agency, and Child Protection Services had been in and out of his life, you know, since birth. He had poor school attendance. He was, you know, expelled, suspended from numerous schools. He didn't attain his school certificate because of violence and expulsions. So he had a very, and he also had become homeless at age of 16. And he had committed two quite serious violent offences in his late teenage years and early adulthood. And I then come in to assess them, and they're in their late 30s with a family themselves. And I guess when I assess this couple, what was really impactful about their attachment styles and their internal working models is the way they had changed. So they were very open about their history and their childhood. They had done a lot of work individually and together as a couple to recover from their childhood experiences, and talked very openly about their, you know, the choices they had made. And what the uncle said to me was, you know, we're sitting here bearing our souls to you as a stranger because we don't want our children or our grandchildren to be involved in child protection services. And we want to break this cycle for our family. And I guess we went through and looked at his criminal history. And it wasn't super extensive. You know, those criminal histories, you get the 56 pages
yeah.
of, and there's,
yeah.
But it was violent, and, you know, early on, he had lots of interactions with the police, and he had some sentences for some violent crimes. What he said to me, which really showed his empathy,
yeah.
which, you know, I think he had developed over time,
yeah.
was that not a day goes by that he doesn't take time to think about the impact him and his actions have had on other people that he experienced as a teenager and as a young adult. He said, you know, what I think about before I go to sleep every night and what I think about when I wake up most mornings is that I hope all the people I physically hurt aren't detrimentally impacted in the long term because of my actions.
What's how he learned that empathy? But given his history, I wonder how he learned that. I mean, that's another topic for another day.
Another topic. But you,
yeah.
When you think about his socialization as a young child.
Yeah, definitely.
He was, you know, his family were very much involved in the criminal justice system.
Yeah.
He was used as a pawn to steal from early on.
Yeah.
He was socialized to think that crime was okay.
Yeah.
You know, he was smoking at age 10.
Yep.
All the things that when you think about socialization in context being positive, he was socialized in exactly the opposite way.
Yeah.
So over time, here he is with his wife, who also had an equally traumatic childhood. They were raising what I would say very healthy, well-adjusted young boys.
Yeah.
They had done extensive work on, you know, together and separately to recover and repair from their early relationships and their early attachment. They were very clear as a family unit on who their children could and couldn't associate from within their own families,
mm-hmm.
because they still had both family members on both sides where they were still involved in criminal activity. Drug taking was seen as fine for some family members and, you know, family members who were physically abusive and emotionally abusive to their own children. So they had very clear rules on who could and couldn't associate with their themselves, but also their children.
Mm-hmm.
And they were really hard to change their relationships and how they are in relationships to make life for their children a completely different experience than what they had themselves.
God, that sounds amazing.
They were amazing. And, you know, when you get a referral and you get the criminal history, I was thinking, okay, well, yep, this is going to be interesting. I remember sitting at the, you know, in their lounge room on their lounge and this uncle's telling me about his history. And I was, you know, thinking, whoa, there's so much to overcome. And then when we got to how has he got to where he is today, and when he shared that learned empathy, you know, the regret he has and how he wants to do different for his children, but also he was talking about his grandchildren that, you know, his kids were in primary school. He was talking about future generations and really how he safeguarded all of those people from their experiences in childhood.
Yeah.
So their relationships, their internal working model, their attachment styles had changed over time.
Well, and generations, subsequent generations will actually have a much healthier experience of relationships because of that.
Absolutely. I saw a meme ages ago about the cycle breakers.
Yeah.
And it was a picture of this person pushing a bus full of childhood trauma away from their kid.
Yeah.
Really powerful visual imagery.
Yeah, it is.
And that night when he was explaining himself, that is the picture that came to my head.
Yeah.
Both of them just pushing this bus back of all of their trauma because it was not going to impact their kids. And they wanted to care for their niece because they wanted to give her an opportunity to know what family was. They wanted to give her an opportunity to heal and recover.
Yeah.
So she could have the same chance that they got, that they forced for themselves, but they didn't want her to have to wait until she was an adult to do that.
Wow, that sounds amazing.
They were amazing people.
I kind of think we could talk for a long time about this topic. I definitely think we could. But I'm also conscious that we probably shouldn't, because people will probably, you know, who has time to listen to a podcast first for like 2 hours.
No way.
So I'm wondering whether I think what we'll do, Rose, you see what you have. I'm just putting this on, Rose.
Jodie's putting her mouth and voice on.
Is my what? My
calcium
voice. So terrible, isn't it? When I listen back, I think, God, I sound so terrible. Anyway, I'm still going. I think let's continue this conversation next time.
Okay.
Let's do another week on attachment, and we can actually talk about some examples of how you might see the different styles in children. You want to do that?
I do want to do that.
Perfect. All right. And that's a good plan. All right. Well, let's finish up on this one. And then next week, everybody, we're going to talk about part two of attachment.
So we will look much more in depth about attachment styles and how you might see it if the children are young people that you might be working with.
Yeah, I think so. I think that'd be cool.
All right, cool. Well, thanks for listening to the Relational Practice, a Social Work Podcast. Please follow us on Facebook and Instagram.
Please.
Follow our podcast.
Yep.
Wherever you are listening from.
Yeah.
Please also, if you can, rate and review the podcast.
Yeah, please. I mean, that's how we kind of, I mean, I guess that's how this podcast will be out there for other people. The more we get people to rate and review it and to follow us, the more other people will see the podcast. So please, if you like to listen to us, then please do that.
So until next time, stay safe and continue to practice relationally.